Look at this, Michael Lark. For the Historical Society on August, must be the 5th today, yeah. Continuing your history after a 3-year break here with Owen Penner, Judge Owen Penner and his chambers at the Michael Hatfield Federal Courthouse. Owen, it has been quite a while since we last spoke. We did talk a little bit about your first days on the court after your appointment, and in the last interview we did. I was wondering today maybe if we could start off by you just talking about some of the relationships that that you have as a federal judge with your colleagues here at the district court, but also with some of the attorneys that appear before you, and also the appellate court judges. Maybe starting with your colleagues right here in the district court, what can you tell me about how you work together with other judges?
Well, when I first came on the court, Michael, there were a fewer number of judges here. There were six judges, including senior judges. And so we were quite close at that time. And at that time, we circulated each of our opinions, if you will, in briefly to all of the other judges for them to review and make comments on. And we had benefit of Jeff Solomon's very meticulous writing style. He was very wonderful at pointing out how to shorten things up, simplify them. He didn't like purple prose, as he said. He liked direct, straightforward sentences and get to the point, which was wonderful. In fact, he gave us a few sessions which we asked for. He sat down with us and lectured to us for a little while on legal writing. You know, we all had it before. He was very meticulous about it, very helpful.
And
the next was Judge Maloney and Judge Grimes, the other judges that were older than the three of us, Judge Fry and Judge Redman, they came on the bench together. So it was a very congenial time. We've always had them and still do have round bag lunches on Monday noon to discuss assignment of cases and the brilliant things we're going to do the next week. Then Friday noon we have a noon luncheon where we discuss what great job we did or what a terrible mess we made or something, as well as other subjects of interest. When Jeff Solomon was here, he had rather formal luncheons in his chambers every so often, and he would invite the mayor, various people, the governor, people to come and visit with us generally.
Mm-hmm.
So we just continued that after he discontinued it, probably feeling that maybe it wasn't quite precisely ethical thing to do, because those people sometimes wound up in cases in our court, and we just thought that maybe that was not a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
He never abused it, he never caused any problems with it, but we just discontinued that. So we confine our lunches here in the courthouse to the other judges.
Mm-hmm. Was there an upside to those lunch meetings, though?
It definitely was. I mean, we talked about mutual things that were going on in the political world. We got a lot of benefit out of learning their views on things. But some of the judges, myself included, felt maybe that might not be appropriate if someone on the other side of the case involving one of those officials found out we had lunch with their opponent, it wouldn't be too good. doesn't mean that we've cut off all of our relationships with lawyers and politicians. We still have our friends, but we don't isolate ourselves completely in this court. We've lived in the legal world. We know the politicians, we know the lawyers, but we are pretty careful about it. And if there's a case pending or apt to come up in front of us, we stay away from those relationships.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember who some of the politicians and other figures were that attended these lunches?
Yes, I do. I remember Neil Goldsmith came on a couple of occasions. Governor Attia came. Chairman of the Democratic Party, I forgot his name now. There were half a dozen or more different ones that came from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
Mayor, one of the mayors came, I forgot now which one it was.
Mm-hmm. Well, was it significant that it was Judge Solomon that convened these lunches and that? Mostly what you, well, you mentioned Vic Attia, I guess, so they weren't all Democrats.
Oh, no, he didn't. Judge Solomon, even though he was a Democrat when he was appointed to the court, and was quite liberal at the time of his appointment, and had a lot of opposition from some conservatives, he became very much middle of the road. You could not distinguish any liberal or conservative tendencies in his opinions or decisions. He was very good in that area. Most federal judges are. They are appointed for life, and they forget those leanings and try to decide according to law. We sometimes think the appeals judges don't do that, but that's just trial judges. Versus, we think they made a mistake, obviously.
And you said that, was it Gus Solomon's decision then to discontinue these lunches? And
yes, we kind of phased him out. He kind of agreed with us. I think the rest of the judges kind of suggested that maybe we shouldn't do it anymore, and he agreed with it.
Uh-huh, okay. And you sort of started your description of this by saying this is the way things used to be. Has the court changed then in the interim?
I don't think so. We still have our Monday noon, Friday noon lunches. We still share the workload completely. If one judge is behind or needs help, there's always someone willing to help them. It's a very congenial color. Very congenial. We don't have any ill feelings at all among judges, which is not always the case in all federal courts in the United States. This court has always been most congenial, going back to the time of Judge Solomon. He quite insisted on that. He made his way around to all the judges, helping make it clear that that was the way this court was. Judge Scopel, Judge Kilkenny, all of the prior judges of this court followed that pattern, Judge Maloney, and it's lasted. We're determined to have a good relationship.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about examples of relationships in other courts that aren't so harmonious?
Well, it would be pretty hard because I don't know the details. I just know that there are many courts, particularly the really bigger courts, they tend to have more problems than we do in the smaller courts. Los Angeles, for example, we've got 30 judges down there or something or other. So understandably, they can't be as close as we are.
Mm-hmm. Is it just a size thing, or is
well,
it?
I suppose not entirely. Maybe a personality thing. Mm-hmm. I'm sure some federal judges are Yeah, well, tragedy, they're kind of like people.
Well, and you also mentioned that that most of the judges on this court tried. You mentioned Gus Solomon's sort of more middle of the road stance, and that other judges have done the same thing. Would that be true in other courts, or are there political divisions?
I think it's true generally in other courts. In fact, among the federal district judges, there may be some rare exceptions, but generally our job is to follow the law as it's written, and we try to do that. Judge Solomon used to say, it isn't a question of whether you're liberal or conservative, it's a question of whether you have good judgment. About 99% of the cases we have don't involve any political philosophies at all. They involve just the law, applying the law and good judgment to the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that in reading some of the recent news stories about President Clinton's troubles, that, and especially that one decision earlier this year, there was something made of the fact that the judge made the decision in his favor, I guess, was a former law student or of his, and what was that? Don't forget the exact details, but there were questions about.
It was a woman judge in Little Rock, and ultimately she issued a number of rulings against him, and she finally dismissed the case, but I believe tried to apply the law as it existed. I don't think she showed any favoritism to him, and that decision, of course, is appealable on the record, so isn't sound, the Eighth Circuit could reverse it, they haven't shown any disposition to help the president particularly, even though many of them are from Arkansas.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your own relationships with the appellate judges. You mentioned, of course, that no judge likes to have their opinion reversed. but how do you work with the appeals court?
Oh, we have a very friendly relationship. We visit with them twice a year at continuing legal education conferences in the winter and in the summer. And our social relationship with them is excellent. We're friends with them. The former chief judge of the Ninth Circuit, James Browning, once said, "The circuit judge is the mortal enemy of the district judge." And in a legal sense, that's true. In other words, we think they don't use good judgment when they reverse this. Obviously, we wouldn't have done what we did if we thought so. We think they made a mistake. Most of the time, not always. Sometimes when their opinion comes down, we'll say, yeah, that's exactly right. We have dozens of opinions going up to them all the time, and most of them are firm. Occasionally when they reverse us, we will be able to read it and agree that we were wrong. Most of the time, of course, we don't feel that way. We feel they made a mistake. They didn't understand the case, didn't understand the facts, rewrote the facts. They've got all kinds of reasons why we're not wrong to be reversed, much the same as people. Judges are kind of like people.
When an appeals court judge is considering a case that comes out of your court, do they do that just in a vacuum, or not in a vacuum, but do they do it without any contact with you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They just do it on the record. See, everything that happens in our court is put in the transcript, and that's what goes to them. They don't talk to us at all about it. Mm-hmm. They hear the lawyers argue the case in some cases the lawyers get to argue that what the transcript said, but we don't discuss it right now.
Is there any conversation about cases once they've made their decision?
Oh, yeah, it's not uncommon for us to say you really bungled that one to the panel judges, or how could you possibly arrive at a ridiculous decision like that? And they usually say, well, we were dealing with a ridiculous one or something or other, you know. So there's a lot of good-natured banter, especially here in Oregon. We have wonderful appellate judges personally here. Judge Levy, Judge O'Scanlan, formerly Judge Kilkenny, and now Judge Graber. They're wonderful people. And they come to our Friday lunches frequently, and we give and take over cases. But we don't get nasty about it. Mm-hmm. We're professionals. We don't get nasty. We may say we're not sure we understood that one or something of that nature, but most of it's in very good humor.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of any examples of cases that you've had overturned on appeal that where there was some interaction between you and the appellate judge afterwards, or any significant case that where you thought?
No, I don't, Michael. I'm sure there's been a lot over the years. There's been a lot of agreement, far more affirmances than reversals. Some of the reversals the Supreme Court has corrected him on. It's interesting that the three cases of mine that have been to the Supreme Court of the United States, all three of them were reversals of my decision by the circuit. And then the Supreme Court reversed the circuit and reinstated my decision. So I'm batting 100% with the Supreme Court cases that went on up.
Uh-huh.
Of course, they don't get anywhere near all of them, obviously. But
right.
The ones they've had have demonstrated my philosophy, you know, that frequently the Court of Appeals is wrong.
Do you remember those three cases? Would they be worth discussing?
Yeah, I remember them very well. One of them was Albers against Whitley, who was a prisoner at Oregon State. Albers was. Whitley was a lieutenant or captain there. And the inmates took over the 20, Barracks 20 at the state penitentiary and had barricaded off, and they were defying the prison authorities. And they said they had a guard, and they did have a guard hostage up on the second floor of this 20. The guards, under the direction of Whitley, planned a storming of the barricades, and in the process shot Albers in the leg, who was running upstairs assumedly to get to the hostage, because that's where he was. So they shot him to keep him from going up the stairs when they broke through the barricades. Albers sued Whitley for a constitutional violation, excessive force, shooting him in the leg, and so forth. I threw the case out, dismissed it, said the facts of the circumstances were that the prison authorities had to use their best judgment to protect the hostage and break the insurrection, and it was entirely proper. The circuit reversed it and ordered it sent back to me for trial on merits to a jury. The Supreme Court reversed them and said that what I did was entirely proper.
Uh-huh.
That's one.
And in that case, then, who appealed it to the Supreme Court. That would have been probably the
Whitley
side, right?
The Whitley side appealed it after the circuit reversed me and ordered it to a new trial. The state representing Whitley, and I think Attorney General Frommeyer argued that case to the Supreme Court, and Gene Mechanic argued it for Albers, the prisoner.
Mm-hmm. And you threw the case out just because you didn't feel that
well,
there was...
I didn't feel that there was any law that would, under any set of the facts as I knew them, there was no basis, even accepting everything the plaintiff said is true, there was no basis for him to sue Whitley. Whitley was acting in an emergency under stress, protecting a guard hostage they had, and that was the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what about the other two?
One of them was a State Department of Revenue case against the railroads, the car companies, in which the state of Oregon granted some exemptions of ad valorem taxes to various types of organizations and things, and didn't grant any exemptions to the railroad. The railroad claimed that the state, if they granted exemptions to anyone, had to grant them an exemption from ad valorem taxes. I ruled that the state had a right under the statute and under the Constitution to grant a reasonable number of exemptions. In that case, it was about 30-some percent of the types of organizations they had granted to, and I ruled that the state had the right to do that without exempting any of the railroad cars that were involved. The circuit reversed me, the Supreme Court reinstated my decision and said I was right.
Mm-hmm. And what about the other case?
The other one was a stationery store sued a stationery cooperative under the Robinson-Patman Act, unfair trade law. Because the cooperative kicked the stationery, Northwest Stationers, out of the co-op for what they believed was a good reason. And Northwest sued the cooperative claiming that this was discrimination against them to not allow them to remain as a member of the cooperative. I ruled that they had violated the cooperative's bylaws, and it was not a Robinson-Patman Act violation. It was not a trade discrimination because there was no antitrust issue involved. Neither the co-op nor Northwest had any appreciable market power in the market. The circuit reversed it, and the Supreme Court reinstated my decision.
Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, as you're talking about these cases, it brings up a question in my mind, and that is, given that Congress is constantly enacting new laws, and there probably already are so many laws on the books that take nothing short of a photographic memory to be aware of them all. What do you do in a case that maybe has some either new law or a law that you're unfamiliar with?
Well, with the computer techniques we have now, Westlaw and Lexis, great law clerks, they can find anything, statutes or cases that have come down on point. And the lawyers are excellent in this court about citing us to the cases that apply. I don't have to remember anything. I just have to be able to analyze it after it's laid out for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I may have to read it and reread it and study it. But we get it laid out for us.
Mm-hmm. What about the attorneys that you deal with? Can you tell me a little bit about, maybe in general, what your relationship is like with attorneys that appear before you representing their clients, and cite some examples of people that have been before your court many times that you maybe have a longer term relationship with?
Well, I think here in Oregon, we consider that we have the most professional, ethical, and competent attorneys probably in the whole United States. We see lawyers from Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, everywhere. Our lawyers that practice regularly in this federal court here are as good or better as any we see, and they're highly professional, highly ethical. And so, on a general basis, we just all agree we have superb lawyers here. Or it doesn't mean you won't occasionally get a lawyer that isn't prepared or is unprofessional, but it's very rare. As far as close personal relationships with lawyers, we don't have those anymore. If we do, we disqualify ourselves from that case, but I don't have any that close. I have an acquaintanceship with lots of lawyers, lots of lawyers. I belong to the Federal Bar Association, the District Court Historical Society, the Oregon Historical Society. I'm working with lawyers all the time on various things. They know that means nothing when they come into court. They come into court, they're just lawyer A. And if I don't know the other lawyer, that doesn't mean one thing either. He's lawyer A or B, and you listen to their arguments just the same. It isn't the lawyers that are involved in the case, it's their clients. And so I think I have done lots of anonymous polls of lawyers that have appeared before me last 2 or 3 years. I'm doing one right now. Anonymous, the clerk sends them out. They're told that I will never see their sheets, don't sign them. Send them in, the clerk will tabulate the results and give me the results only. So I go a lot by those on evaluating my work. For many years I quit doing that because there was a federal almanac that did it. But those reviews in the federal almanac came out so good in recent years that I didn't think they were being accurate either day, or I lost my touch at being mean because they were so complimentary that I decided again to do my own, which I'm doing now.
And are you getting different results?
Well, they haven't started coming in.
Oh, I see. Okay.
We'll just have to see. That won't be for several months yet.
Uh-huh. And what kind of survey is this? What kind of questions do you ask them?
Well, they ask, is the judge courteous, patient? Is he up to date on the law? Has he studied the matter before he decides? Is he fully prepared? Is he on time? Are his decisions prompt? And there's a range of from poor to excellent. They can check in each one of those areas. Does he favor the government in criminal cases? Does he favor the defendant in criminal cases? Does he favor plaintiffs in civil cases? Does he favor defendants in civil cases? Does he favor one lawyer over another? All kinds of things like that.
Mm-hmm. And when the federal almanac, because that was the other body that does this, when they do that, is that just that for information only kind of feedback to the judges?
For information to the lawyers, basically. The lawyers have access to that, so that if a lawyer is coming from New York out here in the case in front of me, he can look at it and see what other lawyers have said about me.
Uh-huh, so you can get sort of a sense of who you are before you...
Generally, I am known as a judge who really keeps things moving, requires discipline and structure, hard work, and expeditious handling.
Mm-hmm.
That's what almost all of my surveys and involvement have indicated, and I know that's true. A lot of work right now. I've told the District of Arizona I'd take their 20 worst cases and send them to me, and I'd handle them from here on the phone and go down there and try them when they're ready. And I've set all 20 of them for trial in a space of 6 weeks down there. And the lawyers are saying, "Oh, this will never work." And I'm saying, "Well, we'll see. I suspect it will."
Mm-hmm. How do you wind up trying cases in Arizona?
Well, we have a system of helping out districts that are in trouble. And the District of Arizona, has been behind for a number of years, really behind. Their judges can't catch up. They're under heavy pressure, lots of cases filed short of judge appointments. And so I just volunteered to the chief judge that I would take 20 cases.
Mm-hmm.
They assigned those 20 cases to me. I had access through the internet to their dockets down there. We had telephone conferences. The only time I'll have to go down there will be for the actual trial. And by the time that gets ready, half of them will be finished by motions to dismiss, summary judgments, settlements, something or other. It's amazing how they get taken care of. The ones that don't, we'll try.
Mm-hmm.
There's three or four antitrust cases. They're tough cases. One of those is the one I was talking about, the patent case.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. After a hearing yesterday, as a matter of fact, the lawyer said, "We think maybe we ought to have a settlement conference with another judge." And I know that case has been pending 4 years. The only reason they're doing that is they both realize now they've got to go to trial in November. They asked to continue, and I denied it. And so they probably will settle it.
Mm-hmm. When you do your own survey, do you just keep that information to yourself, or do you actually send it on to the Federal Almanac too?
No, I don't send it to anybody. It's for my own benefit. I do share it with the other judges and encourage them to do surveys. I think it's very helpful to us because you get comments occasionally that will help you. Maybe you do get a little too impatient. Maybe you do get, if you get a number of responses, I mean, you're always going to get a few bad responses. This is what I didn't like about the Federal Almanac. All I saw were excellent responses, excellent judge, well prepared, all this. Well, you know, when you're ruling against one side, they're not always going to be favorable. So you have to take a kind of cross-section. Average. So the clerk will tabulate the number of results in each of those categories for me, so I can tell whether, wait a minute, I may have a deficiency here. The other thing, I'm now 74 years old, and I have been before judges who were rather senile in my days as a lawyer, and I know that none of us are really capable of deciding when we are losing touch a little bit, and so I'm going to kind of leave that up to the lawyers too. If I begin to get bad results, why, I'll have to think about backing off.
Your senior status now.
Senior status.
Yeah. What kind of work week does that mean for you then?
Well, I'd probably work an average of about 30 to 35 hours a week on average. Some weeks longer, some weeks shorter.
Mm-hmm.